You know, I was watching TV the other day and I was struck by how many terrible commercials there were and all this terrible marketing out there. So I decided it's time to talk about some really good marketing examples. Let's check it out.
Welcome to the Content Toolbox Podcast, intended to equip and encourage experienced business owners and aspiring entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Jen Neal, entrepreneur, coach, active business owner, tech lover and nerd, and founder of the Content Activation Method. Now enough of this, let's get to the good stuff.
If you're new here, I'm Jen Neal, founder of Formula Done, and we help online marketers find and attract traffic and qualified leads using content that you're already developing. If any of those things sound interesting, be sure to check out some of the other videos on our channel and make sure you subscribe so you get notices when we get new ones coming out. Okay, mess out of the way, let's dive into the good stuff and talk about some amazing marketing examples. So the first thing is, I know given the pandemic and how especially the travel industry has changed, I myself am a huge fan of cruises. So I'm on like all these different cruise sites and everything. And something happened during the pandemic when it looked like we were starting to kind of make that shift. And maybe they had done it before and I just hadn't seen it. But all of a sudden, the cruises started partnering with credit cards. So all of a sudden from American Express, I'm getting these notices saying, hey, use your miles to book a cruise, even though my card is for like Delta Airlines, right? I thought that that was a really brilliant move on the part of the cruise lines, as well as the way that the cruises are positioning a lot of it is, one, are you feeling kind of tired of being cooped up? And two, no worries if you have to change your plans. So they're making it sort of a risk-free guarantee, which I really, really love, especially right now where there's a lot of mistrust, sort of, especially in travel plans. And I know we're starting to come out of that, but that was something that I just thought was really brilliant with the cruise lines to position that way. Up next, my husband is a beer drinker. Actually, I used to enjoy it too until I found out can't have the glutens. So one of the favorite breweries that he likes is Stone Brewery. It's been several years back, but all of a sudden, the Stone beers that we had, the labels were on upside down. I don't know if anybody else saw this, but we're like, that has to be a mistake. There must have been a mistake in the bottling facility, right? Apparently, this was their whole plan, right? So they came out with the upside down labels and they didn't even say anything or respond to anybody saying, hey, did something happen with your labels for a couple of weeks. And so what happened was all this buzz started generating because people were like, oh, they screwed up. Oh, something's wrong. So they got like all this free advertising out of what was normally just labeling of their bottles that they normally had to do, right? All they did was flip it around. Then they came out and they said, okay, yeah, we did actually flip these around because we wanted to highlight that mistakes that we've made in the past, mistakes that we've made in our brewing process and in our recipes and things, those are the mistakes that we learned from that brought us to making the ultimate craft beer that we are right now. And I thought that was just genius because it didn't cost them anything extra. They just literally flipped that around. And I felt like that was an amazing marketing strategy. And to take it even further, that idea has been adopted from craft brews. I think they put together an association. I'm sure somebody will probably correct me on this, but like craft brew association or something. So now all of the craft brews, if you're a beer drinker, that are participating as part of this association on their labels, even though most of them are running them right side up, the craft brew part is upside down. And so when you're looking at the label, you're still like, wait, why is this upside down? So there's something about that that just stuck and it became kind of the brand of the association that all these breweries put together. So I thought that was pretty amazingly genius. I really, really enjoyed that. So the fact that Stone did something that caused such attention and got all this press write up and all these things happening without it really costing them anything else. So the fact that they did that is an excellent example of guerrilla marketing. I totally have a confession for you guys. So for years, I have had the misconception of guerrilla marketing. I'm like, I don't like that guerrilla marketing style. Because in my head, guerrilla marketing was like hardcore closing techniques, like super aggressive direct selling. And I'm like, that's just not my thing. I equated it to guerrilla warfare in my head, right? And so like that just made sense. Turns out I was totally wrong. So I just want to give you guys a definition in case anybody else is out there thinking the same way that I was. Maybe I'm the only idiot. Who knows? But guerrilla marketing is the creative use or novel unconventional methods in order to boost sales or attract interest in a brand or business. These methods are often low and are no cost and involve the widespread use of more personal interactions or through viral social media messaging. So really what it is a creative way to position your product that is typically low cost and speaks to the masses. So it's usually some sort of an interesting placement or something that's just totally creative that is not the norm. Like a billboard that's interacting with the other environment outside of it. In theater, we call that breaking the fourth wall. It's like when you're talking along and all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, can you make sure that you edit that out for me, right? So it's you're breaking that like normal convention. And that causes people to kind of snap out of the norm. And done right, it's a super effective strategy. Turns out it's something I've liked all the time. I just never really understood that it was called guerrilla marketing because I had it totally messed up in my head. So there you go. All right. So I want to share the next example here, which is honestly one of my favorites. And this is from the Harman Brothers. The best example that I have is the Squatty Potty. So if you have not seen the Squatty Potty commercial, go check it out on YouTube. We'll share a link down here. It's a little stool that positions your body in a way that you are more likely to be more successful in the restroom. It's probably the nicest way I can say it. But because it's such a difficult thing to talk about, they took it to the extreme. What they did was they used a unicorn to show exactly how your body should be positioned when you're sitting on the throne, right? And the unicorn actually like poops out rainbow sherbet into a cone. And so they've taken a nasty subject and flipped it around, and it's absolutely hilarious and I freaking love it. And I love the way that the Harman Brothers put together those commercials. And it was like super viral. It was a super successful marketing strategy. Inexpensive strategy? No, not really. I know last time I looked, the Harman Brothers are like at least $100,000 to hire. But they've done some really amazing commercials. And one of the things that I loved most was their book, From Poop to Gold. And you can check that out on Amazon. It goes behind the scenes into the agency and how they structure their agency, how they actually come up with these creative ideas. And then they talked about Squatty Potty in there, as well as some of their other projects, as well as BedJet, which I also own a BedJet. And it's just fun the way that they take the common problems and really just blow that up and turn it around in a way that you aren't expecting. So check out those ads. I think that they're amazing examples of super successful marketing strategies and obviously very, very creative, and kind of give you some ideas of how you might be able to think outside the box. All right, so I mentioned at the beginning of the episode that the reason that I was inspired to do this was because I was watching television and I realized I've been trapped in this little bubble, like blissful little bubble, of not having to actually watch any television commercials. Most of us that are doing all the streaming, like that's not a thing that we have to deal with anymore, right? However, I am addicted to this show. It is on the History Channel, and the only way to watch it is you have to end up watching some of the commercials that they build into it. The show that I was watching was The Food That Built America. And if you haven't watched it, especially as an entrepreneur or a business owner, I literally need to go back and rewatch all of them with a notebook, because the marketing lessons that you can take away are amazing. And the strategies, the marketing strategies that they came up with, and a lot of these guys were doing guerrilla marketing tactics without even realizing that that's what they were doing, is before the term was even necessarily coined. And so I highly, highly recommend the show. One of the ones that I think is a great example of fantastic marketing strategies, which all of these things came out of necessity, so it's so genius, was an episode called The Pizza Wars. And this was between when Pizza Hut and Domino's were first coming out. So Pizza Hut, I won't even go into that one, but the reason that Pizza Hut is called Pizza Hut is not because it was some ingenious name. It was literally like how many letters they had available on the free sign that was given to them. So they had to figure out a way to make it work. The whole thing is truly amazing, down to the look and feel and the branding of Pizza Hut came just purely out of necessity. So I want to focus on Domino's though. So Domino's were these two brothers that put together these restaurants. And when they first started the restaurants, they were having a really, really difficult time being profitable, being successful, because their menu was like really overcomplicated. Sounds familiar. I think that I've been down this road before. So they were having a hard time keeping all of the ingredients that they needed because they were selling other sub sandwiches and specialty items and salads, as well as pizza. So one of the brothers decided to actually niche this down and say, we're only going to sell pizza. And that worked. Then they had this really small building. And at the time, when you went out to eat, you went out to eat. The only places that were doing any kind of delivery were a few Chinese food kind of restaurants, but the service was terrible. So you knew that if you ordered, it was going to be a long time before you actually got your food. So the idea of delivery food was not a thing that people were accustomed to. And so the building that Domino's had was very, very small. So they're like, how can we sell more of these and not worry about having to seat people in the restaurant? So this is where the idea of we'll deliver it in 30 minutes or less, or your order's free, was born. And just that simple, because all he was trying to do was sell more pizzas, right? And he came up with this, he literally invented the delivery service as we know it. And then they also ended up inventing pizza boxes because the ideas worked so, so well that their delivery drivers were trying to deliver all these pizzas. So back then it wasn't the corrugated box. It was like a thin one structure cardboard, and the weight of the boxes would end up sinking. And you know what happens when your pizza boxes do not do well. So they were getting complaints about bad delivery and the product being destroyed and all of that. So they actually invented the corrugated pizza box so that they could stack them higher and the delivery people could take more. So pretty amazing, especially the 30 minutes or less, which still is around today, right? It's an amazing strategy, totally, completely creative and worth it, and came out of necessity. Another episode that I want to highlight is the soft serve battle. So this is the battle between Carvel's and Dairy Queen. So I'm not familiar with Carvel's because I know that's an East Coast thing, but they ended up developing a different way. At the time, ice cream was only served super hard. And so, you know, it came out of necessity because the ice cream was melting and they had a whole batch and needed to sell it. And so it was like, well, they both discovered in their own way that the ice cream actually tastes better when it's not as hard frozen because more of the flavors come out. And then they both figured out a way to make that sustainable through the soft serve machine. So they both kind of invented some different ones. But here's what I really, really love in terms of a super creative marketing strategy. So at this point in time, imagine a world where soft serve ice cream did not exist. The only time you ate ice cream was super hard. So they invent this thing, Carvel's opens, and he's like, this is going to be amazing. Nobody comes into the restaurant. It's a complete flop. And he's like, we really have to show them that there's value here. And he literally on that spot invented the BOGO. He's like, that's it. I'm going to tell them you buy one, you get one free. And that is the thing that ended up completely transforming his business and allowing him to franchise and all of the franchises. To this day, I understand they still use the buy one, get one free model. So it was super creative in the time and something that we kind of take advantage of now. But it really gets me to thinking, like, given the circumstances that we are in now, what are the things that we can do that can be creative to still adjust to our audience? And that's part of why I love watching that show. Okay, I've shared a couple of really creative marketing examples with you guys and strategies that have been amazing and worked both now and in the past. But now I get to talk about one of my very favorite things, which is Formula One racing. And as I was kind of pulling together some ideas for this episode, I realized that F1 racing is an example of how marketing and a really good marketing strategy actually saved an entire industry. So it started in the 20s with like the Grand Prix races, the little cigar box cars, you know, that we see. Those guys were freaking crazy, by the way. And it became really popular. All of F1 races and the Grand Prix as a spectator sport as well started to become really popular in the 50s, 60s, and then it's really grown, right? So Bernie Ecclestein, who is a British business tycoon, I can't say that five times fast, he took over Formula One in the 70s and he did amazing things for the sport. He really helped transform it. He helped put in safety protocols and he completely brought Formula One racing forward. And F1 is kind of the epitome of car design and speed and, you know, new aerodynamic technologies and all these things. But what happened is by 2016, what happened was the fan base was kind of getting old, right? So there's all these people that grew up with it in the 50s and 60s. It started becoming really popular. The fan base is getting older and there wasn't anything being done to really continue that fan base because it was catering to the racers as a racing event. But then what happened is, I think it was Liberty Media, they came in and they flipped the whole thing around. And they said, all right, instead of treating this just like a sporting event catered to the races, we're going to treat this and we're going to cater to the fans first. So they brought in AWS, the Amazon database powerhouse, right? So on all of the broadcasts, they brought in all of these data streams so that you can see what's happening as the laps are progressing. You can see the G-forces that the drivers are being subjected to. You can see how fast the cars are going. You can see when they're braking, like real-time analytics of the drivers and the cars and the race strategies and the whole performance across the way. So it becomes this much more interactive thing where the fans feel much more involved. And so all the technical things that happen, they've brought all of that into the race using the data powered. The commentators are constantly explaining to the audience, here's what's happening. Here's why this is a good strategy. Here's what's good. Like they're actually talking to the audience and just sort of translating what's happening between the drivers and the race to the audience. And so that was kind of a big step there. Another step that they did is, so prior to 2016, the drivers were not allowed to have social media profiles or be on social sharing any of that. And now they opened it up. And so the drivers and a lot of people on the teams and stuff, they're sharing behind the scenes what's happening. And so that allows you as a fan to become a super fan because you feel like you know these people, you know, you're seeing into their life, their training schedule, all the things that they're going through really kind of draws you in. And I found that super fascinating because all of those things increased their fan base. And this is just a really long tail strategy, right? But what they're doing is connecting with their audience in a real and personal way. So I have a couple of stats here. The sport itself has a turnover of $4 billion with a B dollars annually. They employ over 50,000 people in 30 different countries, and it's definitely the pinnacle of prestige, glamour, technology, and speed. That it is. It is the ultimate in terms of car racing. It's been a whole transformation, and now it has actually worked because 61% of their new fans are under the age of 35, and 25% are between 16 and 24 years of age. There's a whole new sort of era of F1 that's blossoming, and probably the biggest thing that they did, which was genius, if you haven't caught any of this, they took all that behind the scenes knowledge and the data and the drama and the personalities and all the stuff that's happening behind the scenes. They put that into a Netflix show called Drive to Survive. If you are at all interested in F1 racing, go check out Drive to Survive. There are several different seasons. So they take the whole season and the next year they recap it. So you can actually see an entire, like everything that happened last season. And from the perspective of what's happening inside the teams and the drivers and all of that. And I think all of those things have contributed to a renewed interest in fan base, which has contributed to new interest in broadcasting. So now F1 is making more money from broadcasting where that used to be never part of their income at all. So they actually created a whole new income stream by focusing on the fans, which I think is an amazingly brilliant marketing strategy and something that we can kind of be thinking about, like how do we incorporate that into our businesses in a way that, you know, it's really going to waken people up and create those true super fans. So turn to F1. I always do. But do check out Drive to Survive if you're at all interested. It's a fantastically amazing introspective into how to flip marketing around so that you're actually really sharing the humanity of what's going on in your business. So that's it. I hope that you have enjoyed this super broad sweep of all sorts of different marketing strategies, really good creative techniques. And we even got into talking about some guerrilla marketing and my lack of understanding of guerrilla marketing techniques. But I think they are all amazingly fantastic, and I do hope that you get some enjoyment and laughs out of some of these examples. I'll see you on the next episode.